The title of our sermon this morning is When Bad is Better. Now, conventional wisdom says that good things happen to good people, bad things happen to bad people. We reap what we sow. But we discover as we read Ecclesiastes that sometimes prosperity is not good and adversity is not bad. Now, last Sunday's wonderful, rousing youth service gave us all a boost. Now, today we resume our study of Ecclesiastes, chapter 7, verses 1 through 14. And I'm afraid that Solomon brings us back to earth with a thud. Check this out. Chapter 7, verse 1. The day of death better than the day of birth. A preoccupation with death and disaster colors this whole section. But there are some slivers of life. Now, aren't you glad that you came to church this morning? Christian philosopher Peter Kreeft has written, Ecclesiastes is a bright book of life. It is bright precisely in its dazzling darkness. It is a book of life precisely because it honestly and nakedly confronts the fact of death. It is a great, great book because it explores deeply and uncompromisingly a great, great question. What are our lives here under the sun for? Now, Solomon has asked two questions at the end of chapter 6. When referring to the author of Ecclesiastes in this message, I'll usually refer to him as Solomon, although Solomon's name is never mentioned. The author is said to be someone named Koheleth. Koheleth is a title, not a name. Koheleth means preacher or teacher. So sometimes I'll refer to him as the preacher, sometimes as Solomon, but just want to make it clear that if Solomon did not write this book, a Solomon-like person is intended to be in our minds as we read through this. So the preacher, Solomon, has asked these two questions at the end of chapter 6. For who knows what is good for a man in life? During the few and meaningless days he passes through like a shadow. Who can tell him what will happen under the sun after he is gone? Now, we prefer cut and dry answers to questions like this. Just give it to me straight. What's good for me? What is my life for? Surely prosperity is good for me. Surely good health and a long life are good for me. Surely sharing a meal with good friends and savoring a perfectly made cappuccino, that can't be bad. But Solomon doesn't give us easy answers. In chapter 7, verses 1 through 14, he shifts gears with an abrupt change in style. Instead of musings about the enigmas and the contradictions of life, he gives us a series of brain teasers in the form of better than proverbs. Now, these proverbs may appear to be haphazardly thrown together, but they're not. Two groups of things, one is good and one is better, are set aside for our comparison. Now, some things are better than others. Some of these better things are rather jarring, however. So let's take a look. What is the good life? Solomon gives us a provisional answer by dealing with aspects of life that either infuriate us or frustrate us. Prosperity is not always good. Adversity is not always bad. The mature man or woman will learn to be wise by valuing what is better and best in life. This is not about good and bad, black and white. It's about good and better. And the question he's answering in this section is, will my faith survive hard times when the good old days are gone and the days of adversity have come? Another way of asking this is, what does the preacher teach us about the good life in times of adversity. Now, the first thing we see is we have more to learn from death than birth. That's verses 1 through 4. Follow along with me. A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Frustration or sorrow is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure. Now, last year at the Cannes Film Festival, director Woody Allen was asked how he felt about getting older. I find getting older a lousy deal, Allen explained. There is no advantage in getting older. I'm 74 now, and you don't get smarter, wiser, more mellow, or kinder. Your back hurts more, your eyesight isn't as good, it's a bad business. I advise you to avoid it if you can. When he asked about how he felt about death, Allen deadpanned, "My relationship to death remains the same. I'm strongly against it." "I'm not afraid of death," he said on another occasion. "I just don't want to be there when it happens." Now, in verses 1 through 4, the preacher speaks openly and frankly about death. He begins by saying, "A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth." Now, he's not arguing that death is preferable to life. He's not making a general statement that death is good and life is bad. Precious ointment is not bad. It was used for festive occasions. Oil is great, but there is something better, a good name. A good reputation money can't buy. Well, that's clear enough. But then he says, the day of one's birth is a good and precious thing, but death is better. How do we make sense of that? Why is that? The answer is, we have more to learn from death. Taken by itself, the second line of verse 1 seems very extreme. The verse is explained, however, in verse 2. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Now, only the living go into the house of mourning. Only the living take what they learn there to heart. This is not about one's own death. One's own death is not better than the day of birth. We go into the house of mourning to sorrow at the death of a friend or a loved one. But every funeral anticipates our own. We mourn, but we also learn. And when we learn, we are not diminished, we grow. The living, Solomon says, should take this to heart. By pondering the reality of death and the brevity of life, we may gain insight and maybe even wisdom about living. Now, laughing, feasting, singing, being born, these are not bad things. The birth of a child, the graduation of a son or a daughter, a victory celebration, a wedding, these are all festive occasions, and it's appropriate that we rejoice. You don't toast newlyweds on their wedding day, however, by saying, "By the way, you realize, don't you, that you're both going to die someday." But Solomon says frustration, or the word actually means sorrow, is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. Now, foolish people don't like to think about death. They learn nothing from it. They just want to party. They are in denial about their own mortality. Laughter becomes like a narcotic to drown out their pain. Sorrow and sadness are appropriate responses to the death of a loved one. It is right for us to grieve and to cry and to mourn. So Solomon says, sorrow is better than laughter. Now here's the New Living Translation of verses 2 and 3, and it brings out the meaning a little clearer. Better to spend your time at funerals than at parties. After all, everyone dies, so the living should take this to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for sadness has a refining influence on us. There is a mellowing that takes place in affliction and sorrow. As we stew in our sorrows, we are marinating in God's grace. God is tenderizing us. A sorrow forces us to face the crucial issues of life. What am I here for? What will I do with whatever time I have left? My father passed away in 1996, and part of the process of settling his affairs was cleaning out his apartment. And going through this stuff is an important part of the grieving process, an important part of saying goodbye, of letting go. Now, Dad didn't have much, and he had a very small apartment. He had mostly just art. He was an artist, a sculptor, and a painter. And so I made the decision which pieces would go to my brother and my sisters. We also found that Dad was rather careless with money. We found $20 bills stuffed into his easel, stuck into his bookshelf. It was rather like a treasure hunt going through his apartment looking for $20 bills, and we never could figure out why did he do that. Maybe he just wanted to give his inheritance away that way, and whatever the reason is, I don't know. There was one piece, his final piece. It was unfinished, and it was in plaster. It was a figure of himself, the only self-portrait he ever did. And it shows him standing in front of a pedestal, and on the pedestal is a lump of unshaped clay. And the picture depicts the creative process in the very beginning when the artist looks at the clay, and the clay sits there inertly as if to defy the artist, make something out of me. That was the piece that I claimed for my own. And it now sits on our mantle above our fireplace at our home. It reminds me to ask the question, what will you do with the clay that you have been given? And I learned something in the house of mourning, and I gained something. The wise take it to heart, Solomon says. The second point that Solomon makes is in verses 5 through 7. Honest feedback is better than hollow praise. It is better to heed the rebuke of a wise person than to listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. Extortion turns a wise person into a fool, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Usually when we're going through adversity, we want friends around us who will encourage us and comfort us and give us wise counsel. Sometimes we prefer the song of fools to the words of the wise. And the fact is that what we need is to be told the truth. And Solomon understands this, is we need people who are honest enough to correct us, honest enough to confront us about areas of needed growth or change. And Solomon understands that honest feedback is better than hollow praise. The third point that he makes is that patient hope is better than harboring resentment or wistful thinking. That's in verses 8 through 10. The end of a matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride. Do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. Do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. Now, Solomon has more things to say about adversity and how we face it in these verses. The end of a matter is a reference to a season of trial or testing. A matter is that season. The end result is what makes a season of adversity worthwhile. If we're stuck in the middle of it, it seems like at times we're not gaining anything from this. It's just a nuisance, or it's painful, it's difficult. We can't figure out what value does this season of testing have in my life. But verse 8 makes the point that present circumstances are a poor gauge of true success. As in a race, the only measure that counts is the finish line. But how do we weather through such seasons of testing? Well, we need patience. That's what Solomon says. We need patience to see how things will turn out in the end. We should not be too proud to ask for help, or as we say in our family, borrow brains. Marie has short-term memory loss, and I have long-term memory loss. Between the two of us, two brains are better than one. We make a formidable brain. But when we're trying to recall details from the distant past, I have to rely on Marie's memory. When talking about what happened yesterday, she has to trust my memory. Between the two of us, we make a pretty formidable brain. But whatever the case is, patience is needed to see our plans achieved. In all cases, it's better to wait on God's timing than to be impatient. The fact is that God is doing good things in us while we wait. It is the way God purifies our character and shapes us into the people he wants us to be. My friend Ben Patterson has written, waiting is not just a thing we have to do until we get what we hope for. Waiting is part of the process of becoming what we hope for. Also, it will not do us any good to get angry and resentful at God when things don't seem to be going our way. The Hebrew word translated anger in the text is ka'as, and it means to be annoyed, exasperated, or resentful. It is to be angry about one's misfortunes. The image here is that of a baby snuggling in its father's lap. The foolish person, coddles his vexation, nurtures it, lets it grow. It's a very vivid picture of that which causes you to be angry, of holding on to it and nurturing it and not letting it go. All the time we are nursing a grudge. We're angry or resentful at God because of the string of events that seem to be making our life so difficult. All the time we're nursing a grudge, it is eating us up inside. So the book of Hebrews calls this a root of bitterness by which many are defiled. It will also do us no good to worry about things over which we have no control, or to wish for the return of the good old days. Wise people carefully learn from the past, but they live in the present with all of its perils and opportunities. Each season has its own particular difficulties and opportunities. That's why faith is needed. Fourthly, wealth is good, but wisdom is better. That's verses 11 through 12. And I'm just going to let that stand as is, because that makes sense to us. Solomon says that wisdom is better than wealth for the simple reason that it's life-giving. Number 5, consider this. Both good times and bad times have their uses in the economy of God. That's verses 13 through 14. Consider what God has done. Who can strengthen what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. And when times are bad, consider this. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, no one can discover anything about their future. We just don't know what comes next. Now, let's put that knowledge which wisdom gives to use and consider the work of God. The key word here is the verb consider. The Hebrew word means to see, and its use in both verses links the two verses together. In this context, it means evaluate, discern, and come to a proper conclusion. And what conclusion is drawn when we consider what God has done in our own lives? From our viewpoint, God's work appears crooked. His management of the world, particularly our world, seems askew. Things don't make sense. We can't figure God out. Why does he do things this way? The reference to God's making crooked does not make a moral judgment on God. Rather, it suggests that from our limited human perspective, we are unable to comprehend the mysterious ways of God. Faith is necessary. It is meant to stress his sovereign control over all events, the good times, but also the bad times. Who can strengthen what he has made crooked? Answer, no one can. So don't knock yourself out trying. There are some things we cannot change, at least for the time being. There are broken things we can't fix, problems we can't solve, storms we can't navigate around. We cannot leverage the course of this world to suit our personal preferences. Instead, we have to trust God. And that's why the good times and the bad times come from God. It does not lie within our power to straighten out what God has made crooked. This should not make us apathetic. We must recognize how little we can do, but we must joyfully trust God. And this does not mean that we should not try to right wrongs or relieve suffering. The teacher frequently protests against those who permit oppression. But these two verses speak of the right response to the ups and downs of life. The believer must look for God's presence in every arena of life. Consider what God has done. There'll be mystery, but there should be trust. Prosperity is not always good. Adversity is not always bad. Sometimes we learn more from adversity than from prosperity. I had a fraternity brother in college named Steve Baker. He was kind of our house sage. He would say these really profound things, and we'd all repeat it. He'd say, "Don't try to understand it, just dig it." Now, of course, he was stoned most of the time he said that, but it made sense to me at the time. In so far as God's crooked ways, don't try to understand it, just dig it and trust him. Warren Wiersbe writes, "God balances our lives by giving us enough blessings to keep us happy, but enough burdens to keep us humble." That's what trials do. They keep us humble. They keep us trusting. They get our attention. They will either make you a bitter person or a better person. It's really your choice. You can either allow pain to be a chisel to shape you or a heavy stone to crush you. And so the psalmist says, "Teach us to number our days so that we may get a heart of wisdom."
To summarize, Walter Kaiser paraphrased Ecclesiastes 7, verses 13 through 14 by saying, "Look with wonder, admire, and silently wait for the result of God's work. The contrasts in life are deliberately allowed by God so that men should ultimately develop simple trust and dependence on him. For prosperity and the goods from God's hands, be thankful and rejoice. But in adversity and the crookedness of life, think. Reflect in the goodness of God and the comprehensiveness of his plan for men. We cannot judge the fairness and the goodness of God's plan by observing only the external features of a person's life. In his comprehensive plan, God has created both prosperity and adversity. In Jeff's sermon a couple weeks ago, of Ecclesiastes 5, he said, and I loosely translate, this is what I wrote in my notes, we protect the ego, and we grasp onto control over our Garden of Eden, but we do it in our own self-sufficiency. And later on in the sermon, he said, God's vision is bigger than anything that we can comprehend. The way to freedom is obedience and surrendering our way. The way out is to follow him, to die to self. 2 months, let me just say, disclaimer, I've never spoken publicly about my health. And the reason being that I have to say that I know so many people in this church that are going through far worse things than I think my journey has been. And so I just want to share with you what I've learned, recognizing that I don't in any way mean to say that neither that I've arrived or that I've been anywhere, you know, that it's that big of a journey. But nevertheless, it's my journey, and I want to just share what he's taught me. And the benefit is really just that. It's what he's taught me. It's what I've learned about God. And that's really the purpose of my sharing with you. 2 months before I developed a major illness, almost 30 years ago, I was having my quiet time in Philippians 3. Paul states, I put no confidence in the flesh, though I myself, having reasons for such confidence. If anyone else thinks he has reasons to put confidence in the flesh, I have more. And then he went ahead and listed his pedigree, his training, his background, his calling, etc., etc. Later on in verse 7, he says, but whatever was to my profit, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. I consider them rubbish that I might gain Christ and be found in him, not having righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which is through faith in Jesus Christ. I wrote in my journal the question, what do I depend on? And then I listed several things. My energy, my great health, my positive attitude, my ministry, and my nursing skills or experience. I didn't really know how to change this lifelong independence and self-reliance. I had always actually been proud of these qualities. I had gone through some childhood experiences that had really led me to a place of trying to take control of my life. That was at the age of 15, I remember telling myself, Marie, it's up to you. You better take control of your life. Because if you mess it up, it's your life, and if you do anything well, it's your life, because nobody else is going to scoop it up for you. And at 15, I thought that was pretty good advice. It's all I had. But that's not what Paul was saying in this passage, and I recognized that wasn't true, that really wasn't what Paul was saying. And so I thought to myself, depend on him. I didn't have a clue, really didn't have a clue how to do this. So I wrote in my journal and prayed this really elaborate prayer, and it was, Lord, help me to depend on you. I might add, I hadn't a clue what I was asking for either. After 31 years of excellent health and a healthy pregnancy, my Jenny was born in 1982. I began to experience a variety of symptoms, new symptoms, strange symptoms to me. I remember waking up on the floor as I was on my way to go feed her, and not, how did I get here? You know, and it was like, what? And I remember another time, I had this numbness that was happening in my fingers, and it was creeping up through my whole hand, and it was like feeling like cotton on the end of my fingers. And I also remember losing my handwriting for a while. I couldn't even sign my name, and I remember losing my eyesight. And all these things would come and go. And that was even more confusing. That was even more perplexing. And to make it even worse, I kept losing my brain. I couldn't concentrate. I couldn't solve any problems. I couldn't think. I even had to ask other people for help to just take care of this one little baby. And I thought, what's with that? You can't even take care of a baby? What's wrong with you? I was really confused. I was really depressed. I was really exhausted. I was really at one of my lowest points in my life. And the worst thing was I thought I was losing my marbles. I really did. I thought I should just check into a mental institute. I really did. I thought this, because remember, I'd been so healthy and so proud of it, you know, and so much energy, and I was nothing. I had no energy. I had nothing. Several years later, in 1984, as a result of an MRI, I was definitively diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And the only thing I hung on to in those first early years was my quiet time. That was a habit I'd developed years earlier. It was my lifesaver. And now more than any time, when my brain wasn't working, I began to go back to my journal to read what I had written when my brain was working. I desperately needed to grasp onto his word. I decided to go back and see what he'd been telling me before. It was then that I found that quiet time, written two months before I began the early symptoms of MS, that pivotal quiet time in Philippians 3. And I have to tell you, it gave me such a sense of encouragement. He was teaching me reliance on him, if nothing else. And that's another word for faith, okay? Depending on God is about faith. That's what it's about. That's the journey of faith. And there was a sense also of recognizing that he also was really aware of this. He was really aware of what I was going through, and that he... And though I could not depend on the previous strengths that I had, all those were gone, at least at that period of my life, and I didn't know if they would ever return. You know, that was the bummer. I didn't know if I would ever be myself again. But I did learn that he doesn't change and that he was steadfast. And I began to trust him, again, faith, trust him in greater measure. I was mining deep into who he was in ways that I'd never needed to before. He was growing my faith. Now, I know some of you today are struggling with things that are chronic problems, maybe in your marriage, maybe in your family, maybe with your teenagers, maybe you're out of work, financial problems, and many of you do have chronic illnesses, probably a lot worse than mine. So again, I say, I hope that the little that I've learned, that some of it might speak to you and be of encouragement to you. There are several things that he taught me, four things I'm going to talk, there are lots of things that he taught me, but four things I'm going to talk about today. And those are things that he taught me. To start off with, the first thing that he taught me was just to ask. And what I saw in Scripture was that Jesus was frequently teaching the disciples just that, just to ask. Now, how he answered that prayer request was his prerogative. But it pleases him that we ask. And so I did, and I do, and I still do. I totally believed he could heal me, and that wasn't the issue, but I did not know if that was in his plan. And I always knew it was his plan, not my plan. I never got that. By his mercy, I never had that confused. So I kept on asking, and I welcomed anyone else that wanted to pray with me or pray for me who had faith. I invited them to pray for me too. I even remember at one time I sensed early on that the Lord just reassuring me that he was going to heal me, but it wasn't going to be instantaneously, but it was going to be a long journey. I wrote that in my journal, and I pondered those words with hope in my heart, but there were no changes in my physical being. You know, I didn't wake up the next day and feel all better. You know, I didn't feel anything, but I did have that in my journal. I recognized that he had allowed me to be challenged with one of the most neurologically progressive and unpredictable diseases. For those of you that might not know about this disease, it follows a unique course for every individual, but usually has the progressive degeneration of the myelin sheath. Now, the myelin sheath is made up of little of the covering of neurons, and that's your transportation system for your nerves. My brain tells my body, my legs to walk, tells my balance, stay straight. It tells my words, what words to say, which is why I stumble sometimes. It's a really crucial, in terms of all of those things, And when the progression occurs, it begins by you can have a loss of motor control. Some people have problems with their balance, with their eyesight, and cognitive memory loss, along with a whole bunch of other little symptoms that people with MS know about. At the time that I was diagnosed, I was also told, by the way, that there was no cure. So when times are good, rejoice. And when times are bad, consider that God has made one as well as the other. The second thing I learned was that God cares. On the way to City of Hope for my first MRI in 1984, when I knew what the diagnosis would be given, I asked him in prayer, "Are you going to heal me?" Now, what I wanted to hear was, yes, one little word, yes. But I didn't hear that. Instead, I heard, "Marie, nothing about this disease will ever keep you from accomplishing my purposes for your life." It was so remarkable. I mean, it was so not what I wanted to hear that it was almost like I just kept replaying, "What? What?" You know, and I kept replaying that one sentence. And I thought, and the more I thought about it, nothing about this disease will ever keep you from accomplishing my purposes, God's purposes, for your life, Marie. I thought, well, is there anything else that's really important? And I thought, not really. No, I think if he would do that, that I think I can live with that, okay? I can live with that. Not my plan A, not what I really wanted to hear, but okay. It was a statement I'll never forget. My spiritual mentor and my legal guardian came along a little bit later, and she told me something else that was really encouraging to me. She said, "Marie, don't ever put God in a box. He's bigger than anything you could imagine. And just remember, Marie, he'll do anything any way he wants." Now, I like that. I thought, okay, all right. So I came with a sense of expectation. Lord, I don't know what this journey is going to be like. It's nothing like what I've been. The last 30 years of my life has been so totally different. But you're a great God, and I want to look for those things of what you're doing. And that is what I've experienced through this MS. I've learned about a bigger God, a more creative God, a wonderful, compassionate Father, more wonderful than I ever dreamed possible. However, he is all of those things, whether or not he chooses to heal me. So don't stop praying for me. If you pray for me, keep on praying. But he's God, and I'm not. The third thing that he taught me was to trust him for his solutions, both natural and supernatural. Now, the biggest experience of my supernatural was seeing the coincidence of a lot of factors come together that were essential in the process of providing some of the best medical care that I got. And it's a too long of a story to tell, but it's one in which, as a result of those things occurring when they occurred, I've actually had almost 30 years of probably the best medical care for people that have MS. My neurologist on the East Coast is one of the best in the whole world, and he, along with my Kaiser doctor, well, he treats me like I'm his daughter, like his sister, the one on the East Coast. And the Kaiser doctor always treated me like I was his daughter. So I had this favor that only God could provide. And these people who took an interest and miraculously provided the medical means of the treatment that I've taken for the last 35 years. Excuse me, less than 30 years. But then there's also been, so I consider that the natural medical means. But there's also been a couple supernatural things that have happened that I think are really bring joy to my heart and make me smile. They teach me about a God who does things supernaturally as well. And I don't discount that one's more important than the other, by the way. All of what I share, to me, it's all God's work, whether it's miraculous or natural or anything else. But in 1997, I remember early in the week, it was middle of the night, my son, Johnny, who was 14 at the time, came and woke me up at midnight and said, Mom, I got to pray for you. God told me to come and pray for your healing. And I remember like being dead in the night, and I remember saying, okay, Johnny, keep it short. Keep it short. You know, and in the morning, I remember thinking he'd never done that before, and he's never done it since, you know, but that was sweet. And then I started thinking about that. I thought, I wonder if God's going to be doing some things here. And all week long, I kind of pondered this in my heart, and as the week grew along, I had more and more sense of expectation. By Sunday, I thought, you know what? We were attending the Vineyard Church, and I said, I'm going to go up and get prayer, because I think God wants to do something special. Now, at that period of time, that season, my MS was so bad that I couldn't stand without holding on to something. I used a cane, I used people, I used objects. I completely lost my balance, and so I called it the 95 splat, you know, I kind of tuck and roll, you know, but I was falling all the time. And thank God I'm not bigger than I am, because I didn't break anything, but I knew that I couldn't come in for prayer because you have to stand. So lo and behold, Vicky High came out of nowhere. This was a different church than here, and she's from here, and she came to that church. And I said, Vicky, come sit by me. And she said, come on. Well, you need to go up for prayer. And I said, yeah, okay, you carry my chair, and let's go up for prayer. And so the plan was so that, because if you sit in there, they won't pray for you, because nobody knows that you need prayer, right? You got to stand here, right, when you come for prayer. Well, that's how it was in that church, too. And by the end of the service, everybody had left, and it was just the worship team. And Vicky and Johnny and Steve and a few other people joined around me and began to pray for me. And what can I say? God restored my balance. I came in needing help, and I left in an amazing way. It was a miracle. And it was many, many more details than I want to tell you. But the next week, Vicky brought me this. Because as a symbol of what God had done. And I have this right on our dresser, right in front of our bed. And I have to tell you, some days I don't feel like this, you know. But I know that this is a miracle that God did to remind me that he can do anything he wants. Remember, anytime he wants. That was a really special, special time. A third thing that I want to share with you is a community. The community of Christians is a really important part of his work in our lives. We're not supposed to be doing this journey by ourselves. And the Christian community came in not just for prayer and for support and encouragement, but I am so grateful for the wisdom and in many ways, they stood by me and with me during some really, really dark parts of the journey. I think of Steve and Johnny and my Jenny, my kids, and Vicky High and others from this body of Christ. You know, the worship team, your wife, Patty. I mean, I can't tell you the number of people that God just brought around me to hold me up emotionally and in other ways. And I am so grateful for you and so grateful for this church body. And I guess I just want to say thank you for being that extension of God's hand of healing in my life. The fourth thing I want to share with you is that God, I believe, invites us to participate. It's like a cooperation. There's God's part, which is like 90% or 99% of it, and then there's our part. But our part is really, really important. And whatever your journey might be, there is that. There's both parts of that. And to have a listening ear and an observing, what is it, Lord, what's my part, Lord? What do you want me to be doing to solve this particular, to participate in movement that you want to do in my life? I'll give you an example. In 2006, Steve had cancer and a whole bunch of other health problems. And a close friend gave us a year-long passes to 24-hour fitness. I came along initially just to encourage him. And I was getting bored, so I began trying some of the equipment. And I started with the sitting kind, you know, I tried to just do the bike, you know, and I just moved from one thing to another. And we faithfully went to that, and are still going to that. Much to my amazement, God used that exercise program and continues to use it to build resilience and greater energy, greater strength. I'm even able to run in the neighborhood. I go see Shay's kids, you know, a couple blocks away, don't I? It's like, when I'm running in the neighborhood, you guys got to know I am praising God, because there was a time not that long ago where I could barely get to my mailbox. And going to the mailbox to pick up the mail was just like, That just seemed like an. I might as well have been 10 miles to get to that silly mailbox. And now I run in the neighborhood, you know, and to me that's just all of it. Is I am so gracious. I'm so grateful for what he's done. One of the reasons that I think God has given us this gift of these exercises is because I really believe, as Steve and I get old together, and we are getting old together, we always wanted to get old together. Now we're here. It's as my son says, it sucks, doesn't it? Yeah, it does. Getting old sucks. But I see this as his direction to maximize the number of years we have left for his purposes. And I'm really grateful for that. I'm amazed by that. In closing, I have to admit that some days when I consider what he has done, I find the road crooked. But even so, and though MS was definitely not plan A for my life, I can honestly say that I wouldn't trade this experience if I had the choice to do it over again. He's been building and strengthening my character, my faith, my relationship with him and others in ways that I never dreamed possible. I live with a daily reminder of the preciousness of life and the importance of using time and energy for his purposes. With a grateful heart, I continue to live with MS. Along with Psalm 90:12, I pray, teach us, Lord, to number our days aright, that we may gain a heart of wisdom.